For almost three centuries, Sotheby's has been the place to discover the greatest stories of creativity. We look after some of the world's finest treasures, which you can see on display in our galleries on any given day. Welcome to Sotheby's Talks, the podcast that celebrates art, culture, and collecting. I'm Simon Shaw, and I want to invite you inside the world of Sotheby's, a place where you can find the extraordinary, from contemporary art, master paintings, to jewellery and memorabilia. I'm Vice Chair of Sotheby's Fine Art Division, and during my 28-year tenure, I've championed Impressionist and modern art, setting new benchmarks for artists including Monet, Magritte, Munch, Giacometti, and Kandinsky. On this podcast, focused on legacy, we're sharing conversations we've been holding with our experts, along with the descendants of great artists who shaped the history of art, such as Joachim Bizarro, Christopher Rothko, Bella Freud, and more. Dedicated in 1971, the Rothko Chapel serves as a global destination for all faiths and houses 14 site-specific paintings by Mark Rothko. In this episode, Shahida Bari is joined by custodian of the Rothko legacy, Christopher Rothko, curator and writer Dr. David Anfam, and Sotheby's Lisa Dennison for a conversation about the history of the chapel, its ambitions for the future, and the part it plays in Rothko's ongoing legacy. This podcast was originally recorded to mark the chapel's 50th anniversary, following restoration work to bring the space more in line with Rothko's original vision. Here's Shahida with more.
Hello, I'm Shahida Bari, and I'd like to welcome you to this very special event organized in partnership with Intelligence Squared. Today, we're going to be immersing ourselves in the Rothko Chapel, learning about its history and its ambitions for the future. The chapel is a non-denominational space in Houston, Texas, and it houses 14 murals by the American artist Mark Rothko. And this year, the chapel celebrates its 50th anniversary. We're very fortunate today in having with us three speakers to talk with us about the chapel, the work it houses, and its significance in the body of Rothko's work, and the part it plays in Rothko's ongoing legacy. Joining us from upstate New York is Christopher Rothko. A psychologist by training, he's a writer and the manager of the Rothko legacy. He's also been the chair of the board of directors of the Rothko Chapel and overseen its recent campus enhancement and restoration, of which we'll learn more in a moment. And in London, Dr. David Anfam. David is an international curator, critic, and art writer. He's senior consulting curator at the Clifford Still Museum in Denver and managing director of Art Exploration Consultancy in London. His many publications include Mark Rothko, The Works on Canvas, Catalogue Raisonné, now in its sixth print run, published by Yale. And in New York, Lisa Dennison. Lisa is the Executive Vice President and Chairman of Sotheby's Americas. Before joining Sotheby's, she was the Director of the Solomon R. Guggenheim Museum in New York City. So let's start at the beginning, Christopher. Perhaps you could start by telling us how the chapel came about.
With pleasure. I'm very happy to talk about the Rothko Chapel, which is very near to my and dear to my heart, especially in this 50th anniversary year. It is, as Shahida mentioned, it's in Houston, Texas, but it really belongs to the world. Its reach in terms of its programming, its work in human rights and religious tolerance is global in focus. And we have more than 100,000 visitors every year, many of whom are making essentially pilgrimage to spend time in this truly unique space. The chapel was the brainchild of Jean and Dominique Demenil, who commissioned my father in 1964. They were already very prominent collectors of 20th century art and beyond, already owned several canvases by my father, but they envisioned a space that was going to be quite different. They were devout Catholics, very progressive in their approach, and they, as art lovers, but also as deeply spiritual people, they recognized that perhaps the traditional artwork that you found in a church was no longer speaking to a contemporary audience. And they thought that my father would be the artist who could bring a new language of art and the spirit together and help them create a chapel that would inspire a new generation of people. So they commissioned him in 64, and the first thing he did was take a new studio space that was a very old carriage house in New York with a broad skylight. And he did this so that he could mock up three walls of the chapel. And what I want to emphasize in that project is that for him, this was not simply a matter of making paintings. he was creating a space. He was thinking about the architecture as much as he was thinking about the paintings. That was all part of the experience that he was creating for the viewer. So he set about right away and was paired with Philip Johnson, famous American architect who he had worked with before. And they collaborated on creating a building that was very much of its time. This is St. Joe's Brick, very typical of Houston. And it's a little bit like an Italian Renaissance church. Many of these, you go to Italy and they've never finished the West Front. They're not ornaments on the outside, but the beauty is all inside. And this was really my father's plan, as simple as possible, and to keep the focus on the interior experience. We have here a drawing quite early in the process. Johnson has started with a square. We can see at the top end of this, and my father has already negotiated for an apse, but you can see in the hand-drawn lines on the sides that he is pushing Johnson towards an octagon. This was my father's vision from very early in the process. He was inspired by a number of Renaissance and Byzantine examples. And the Demoniels love this because an octagon is an inherently democratic space. There's not one pulpit from which somebody is speaking to a large mass. In fact, it's a much more in the round kind of space. And that was something that Johnson honored, and they went forward with that plan.
I wanted to ask you a bit more about this working relationship between your father and Philip Johnson, because it was a fraught one. And it would be interesting to know what went wrong. What were the points of difference in their visions for the chapel? You're already starting to tell me, I think.
Yes, they got on quite well initially, and they really were quite cooperative I think Johnson recognized that my father had a vision and he really helped him fulfill that vision. But when they got to the point of how this room was going to be lit, they came to irreconcilable differences. My father, actually mimicking the skylight in his own studio, wanted a large, broad skylight. And Johnson, as you can see in this drawing, wanted a triumphal tower with an oculus at the top. We have to remember that this building was originally going to be on the University of St. Thomas campus in Houston, where Johnson had designed most of the central quadrangle. And this was to be the final capstone, really the final statement that Johnson was making. And he wanted it to be celebratory. This was anathema to my father's mind. And he countered with something that was really quite, quite different and emphasized the humility that he wanted to bring to the project. Of course, he wanted to keep your eyes directly in the picture plane.
I wanted to ask you a bit more about that roof, because there were issues with lighting. And this has been a longstanding dilemma for the keepers of the chapel like you, but one that seems to have been resolved more recently.
Yes, that's right. So the Demoniels sided with my father, and the chapel was completed without Johnson, but according to my father's vision. And you can see in this drawing, this is a drawing that's a little later in the process, and you can see just a little squiggle of a line across that top skylight, and that's a rendering of a parachute, which is what my father had in his studio to control the light. And for reasons that we still don't understand, that parachute was never included when the chapel was opened. My father died well after the commission was finished on his end and the architectural work was done, but the building hadn't been built yet. So a year after he dies, it opens, and it opens, as you can see on the left here, with a completely bare skylight. The room is flooded with light. In fact, you can't see the paintings because the light's all in the center of the room. And it's also a damaging amount of light. It's really not healthy for the paintings. The Demoniels recognized this, and in the early 70s, they put a scrim, and then followed this a few years later with the first of a series of baffles that fit essentially as umbrellas under their skylights and direct the light a little more to the walls. It's a very intrusive architectural presence. The second baffle, which we just replaced last year, it is smaller, but it's quite an ominous presence in the room. It's causing terrible glare and, again, foreshortening the room. And then what we have just created, which restores the full architectural space to the room. And again, I have to emphasize the restoration was not simply about light. It was creating that original space, which is so crucial to our room that is actually relatively small. And we have actually addressed the lighting. I should give credit to the Architecture Research Office and George Sexton Associates. They've simply put louvers, essentially Venetian blinds, under their skylight. Now, understand these are very sophisticatedly computer designed louvers that are angled in a precise manner so that the walls are perfectly illuminated for the first time. The paintings are lit top to bottom, and we once again have a window back in the room. It is a completely different feeling walking into the chapel. One exhales upon entering rather than grabbing the breath to themselves.
It's remarkable seeing its trajectory. We'll come back to the chapel as it is now in a moment, but David, let me come to you, because you've written the catalogue resonates with Mark Rothko's paintings. When did you first encounter the chapel?
Well, I first encountered the chapel in 1977, and Rothko and the chapel have occupied such a large chunk of my life that I have to really take a brisk trip down memory lane. I found myself living in New York in 1977 as an impoverished PhD graduate student researching abstract expressionism, Mark Rothko, Clifford Still particularly. And there's something about being an impoverished student that makes you lean, mean, and I think hungry for knowledge. And towards the end of my year, I decided to take a very big road trip on Greyhound bus. So I did a 2-month trip around the US, starting up in Buffalo with the Clifford Stills of the Old Bright Knox, went from Buffalo to a snowstorm in Boston, a record snowstorm, then Chicago, then over West Coast, San Francisco, down to LA. And this is where things get interesting. LA, I got on the bus all the way without a break to Houston. Now, I didn't go to Houston for the Menil collection. I didn't go to Houston for the Museum of Fine Arts. I went to Houston for one site of pilgrimage, and that was the Rothko Chapel. And that was my very first encounter with. Now, I never thought that at 1977, in 1989, that's 12 years later, I never thought that this graduate student would actually go to Washington, live there for almost 10 years, and write the Mark Rothko catalogue raising of paintings. But that's the way it turned out. Towards the end of that research, even more surprising for me was that Christopher and Rothko chapel people, Paul Winkler was director then, they said, would you do a show around the Rothko Chapel? Of course, I said, yes, absolutely. So what we did was, in fact, put the chapel paintings in a big context to see them in the context of the last decade of Rothko's life. But we have to go back now to Rothko's beginnings, because what became apparent in doing a catalogue raisonné is that Rothko's development from the early, mid-1920s, he started painting around 1925. He died in February 1970. It's one huge trajectory, and there's many interconnections between the decades, the themes, the ideas, the shapes, and everything. Rothko got the commission for the chapel in April of 1964. When I was doing the catalogue raisonné research, I began to realize that there was a whole corpus of painting which Rothko may have begun, and this is absolutely fascinating, before April 1964, but which he certainly continued when he rented a cottage in, I find it very hard to pronounce these Native American names, Amagansett, very, very close to East Hampton, right out in Long Island. We know that Rothko was interested in studying the paintings, and here we have one of the black form paintings you can see at the center. They're almost black on black. What's interesting is that Rothko would contemplate these paintings, we're told, as the light went down towards the end of the day. And when I came to do the chapel commission, we had a pretty big show. And in doing it, I did even more research than the catalogue raisonné had prompted me to do. It occupied 6 galleries of the Menil collection, 6 very big galleries, 38 works in total. So one important thing to remember is that the Rothko Chapel is very much interconnected with Rothko's 2 other murals, dearies, the Seagrams and the murals for Harp. And what we tried to do, what I tried to do in conjunction with Susan Davidson, the curator of the Menil, Carol Mancuso-Ungaro, the chief conservator, Paul Winkler, the director, and above all, the brilliant Walter Hopps, who came up with his own ideas about certain paintings. What we tried to do was to really show that the chapel was extremely complicated. And it wasn't just a one-off thing. The paintings that preceded it, the dark pictures that began in 1957, we included 4 paintings from 1963. which showed Rothko moving towards harder, darker forms. And then, if I've got my numbers right, what I discovered is a group of, I was demonstrating with figures, there's a group of eight numbered paintings, which Rothko had actually numbered on the reverse or on the attacking margins of a canvas. And the fact that Rothko was actually numbering these paintings, the fact that he did a total of 15 black form paintings, plus one red form painting that had the same hard edges as the black form paintings, it tells us that this was like an extraordinarily intense exploration for Rothko of the things that mattered most to him and came out in the chapel. Light, space, texture, opacity, and darkness. What appears here to be a black-on-black painting in the National Gallery of 1964, very, very dark, is actually pushing the limits of perception. When I looked at the back of it, there is an underlayer which you can just see, because it's an imprimatur, a first layer, of a very intense kind of maroon red, which is not like the final black. So these paintings are worked up and layered. So it's an extremely complex project for Rothko, and he's actually all about precision, as he said himself.
Thank you so much, David. That's such a fascinating bit of detective work and really setting out the narrative for us. I want to turn to you now, Lisa, to find out about your experience with Rothko, because you had a kind of baptism of fire on your first day at the Guggenheim, didn't you?
I did. Well, while David, a year ahead of me, was an impoverished art historian in New York in 1977, in 1978, I came to the city and had the great good fortune of being hired as a young curatorial assistant at the Guggenheim Museum. And my very first day on the job, I went to report to Diane Waldman, the curator who did the remarkable Mark Rothko retrospective in 1978. She was on the ramps installing this show, and I said, I'm here and reporting for duty. We looked across the ramps, as you did at the Guggenheim, and there were two paintings side by side, and she said, okay, welcome. And do you think we should maybe reverse those two paintings? And I thought, here I am, a curator for 5 minutes, and I'm being asked to install Rothko's. So, of course, I said, let's try it. And she said, yes, good idea. Go back to your office. See you, you know, in 3 weeks. But Guggenheim, it was a sublime beginning. The show was as beautiful as anything because you had the perspective of across the ramp views, but also the ability when you were standing in front of the painting to be enveloped in the field the way the artist intended. It's actually a crime that the photographs that survive are in black and white. But I will say that the Guggenheim was a chapel of sorts as well when it was commissioned by Hilary Bey, the museum's first director. When she commissioned Frank Lloyd Wright to build the building, she said she wanted a temple to the spirit. And it always has been. Of course, it has skylight and roof, as we see in the Rothko Chapel. And to me, it was always a chapel.
It is really tantalizing seeing them in black and white there, because you have to imagine what they were like, unless you were there, of course, as you were. Tell me about your time at Sotheby's, because I know that a number of Rothko paintings must have passed through your hands during your time there.
Well, ironically, after an almost 30-year career at the Guggenheim, I was sitting in Sotheby's auction room in May of 2007, still the director of the Guggenheim at that point. And this painting, one of my favorite of all times, which belonged to David Rockefeller, was put up for sale. And it was the peak of the art market in that May 2007 season and made $72.8 million. And I just sat there thinking, oh my God, there is a whole different world out here. And maybe I want to be part of this. And coincidentally, I was called by Sotheby's the very next day and asked if I would speak to them. So it was really this painting that was kind of the moment that I always thought made me pivot to this new career. I've had the great fortune of handling many, many Rothkos over my time at Sotheby's. This is one you may recognize, that no longer impoverished art historian David Anbam, participating in an event in 2012 for a painting that we sold, Royal Red and Blue, from 1954. The painting was estimated at $35 to $50 million and sold for $75 million. Anyway, the person I was bidding with had bought five consecutive cover lots at Sotheby's sales. And we were bidding on this painting, which he hadn't seen. And he said he didn't want to really chase the painting. So I was being very dutiful, and we were now bidding. Remember, this bidding started in a $35 million low estimate. We are now bidding, and we're in the $60 million range. And I said to him, you know, we're officially chasing this painting, which I think you should because it's that glorious, but do you want to stop? And he bid one more time, and then we stopped. I always regret that night because it was the last time he bought a piece of contemporary art with me. So lesson there is don't ever stop a bidder. Then, of course, we also had the pleasure of handling Bunny Mellon's estate. She was an avid fan and collector of Rothko's, had nine, of which several have gone to the National Gallery. And last but not least, and to bring things full circle, a painting that Rothko personally selected to give to the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art, and indeed Peggy Guggenheim, to bring the Guggenheim back full circle, agreed to pay for it, and it was gifted to San Francisco. We sold it for them, was estimated 35 to 50 million, and it made over 50 million in 2019. The San Francisco Museum has many beautiful Rothkos, but I love this painting in particular. And they use the proceeds to help diversify their collection and buy younger artists. So I think the trajectory that you see here is that when we have the privilege of selling these paintings, which always have great provenance, they go for well over their high estimates.
Yeah, I can see why, Lisa. I'm in the market. I might talk to you later. Christopher, let me turn to you. And I want to pick up on that lovely phrase that Lisa used, the temple of the spirit, because the chapel is the realization of a complete artistic, architectural and atmospheric vision. But it wasn't your father's first attempt at this, was it? Can you tell us a little more about the difficulties with the Seagram murals?
Absolutely. So my father, I think David had mentioned, had two previous mural commissions. The first one was another project with Philip Johnson, for the Four Seasons restaurants in the new Seagram building in New York. And this was by far and away the biggest and most important commission of his life. And he ended up executing over 30 large-scale murals for a project that was only going to require five. And he thought through and thought through and thought through how to create a space that was really going to be powerful and was going to capture the attention of his viewers in a restaurant. And in the end, he returned the money and withdrew from the project, realizing that he also could not have art competing with food and wine. It was a losing proposition. And it's not the proper place for works that were also tremendously serious in tone. He ended up gifting a large group of these to the Tate Gallery in 1970, where they happily hang to this day. He also was commissioned by Harvard University for a room that had very high intellectual aspirations, the room for fellows, university fellows and academics for a lot of intellectual exchange. But in a very short time, it had become an alumni reception room, and the paintings were really quite badly treated and have largely been in storage since that time. So when the Demoniles approached him, he was already twice bitten, but in fact, they came to him with really his dream commission. He had spoken before about wanting to create little roadside chapels with just a single work where somebody could go and contemplate and spend time, get away from the everyday. And here was the chance to make an entire room and not just create the paintings, but control the space and really create an entire experience. And he felt, as he told the Demoniles in writing on more than one occasion, he was just felt incredibly fortunate and blessed at their trust in him and the opportunity to execute something on this scale.
Wow. And so the third time was the charm, David. Can you tell us a little bit more about the chapel? What's your sense of the space? And can you place it in our historical tradition for us?
Well, it's a very hard question because I can't verbalize it. And that tells you something about the hypnotic effect of Rothko himself. The most I will say is that some years ago, I think after I moved back to London in 97, I was asked to give a lecture in the Rothko Chapel. And I thought about it and I said, I can't do it. Power of the space, sense of atmosphere, what the Germans call Stimmung, Moan. It's so intense that it left me almost silent and speechless. And I ended up giving the lecture in the Menil collection itself, admittedly with two very nice rockers behind me. So it's a unique experience, and the fact that you can't verbalize, the fact that you feel you're moving into a different dimension the moment you enter, it says something about the uniqueness of the chapel.
I think that must be true. But at the same time, we can also see it as part of a tradition, perhaps, this kind of space. Would that be right?
Of course. Yes, that's true. On one level, the idea of painting spaces or interiors, of course, it goes right back to Altamira and Lasso Caves. But I mean, that's like a back history and, you know, cave art. But it really begins as a tradition with the Italian Renaissance. And you think of painted chapels like the Bancalci Chapel in the Carmine in Florence with the great Masaccio murals. You then think of Pontormo, again in Santa Felicita in Florence, to the Capone Chapel. And of course, the mother of all the painted chapels, the Sistine Chapel. I mean, that goes without saying. But we must also remember that something which wasn't, strictly speaking, a chapel as such, also made a big impression on Rothko, and this is a monastery of San Marco, again in Florence, where he was immensely impressed by Fra Angelico's mural. Rothko went to Italy in the midst of the Segre mural series in summer of 1959, and he visited Pistum, which is south of Naples, and he was asked when he was looking at them or studying the whole site, said, "Are you painting Greek temples?" And he said, "I've been painting Greek temples all my life without knowing it." And so this idea of a sacred spiritual space that's deeply rooted in tradition. Don't forget the Greeks themselves thought the gods inhabited their temples. Temples were a site of otherworldliness. And another building which made a great impression on Rothko was a church on the island of Torcello in the Venetian Lagoon. And I think what appealed to him, and you see it on the right, what appealed to him was the simplicity of it. The fact there was nothing between you and the space. There was a direct communion. And then finally, since I'm in London, and in fact, part of the crew doing this is in London, and since we just managed to survive Brexit so far, I wanted to end with a London note. There's a fascinating building in London, and that's the Dulwich Picture Art Gallery. And it's built by the visionary architect Sir John Soane. But that also includes the tomb of the patron, Sir Francis Bourgeois. And it's extraordinary to have a combination of art, the art gallery and the collection, with a tomb in it. And what you get in the Bourgeois tomb is blank tomb, wall, unornamented, and a mysterious light, window, door spaces at the sides, and a mysterious light coming from a hidden source above. It's actually amber-tinted glass. Now, I don't think that Rothko knew, and Christoph confirmed this a while ago, but he knew this. I think it's more a question of a similarity of spirit, really, between places which are unconnected. But it is a fascinating precedent. It's a kind of monumental architecture, which is about the space of absence in a way, I think.
There is a kind of simple melancholy there, isn't there, which perhaps chimes with Rothko's work. Let me head back across the Atlantic to you, Lisa, for a moment, for more examples of where art and architecture come together to create, in that wonderful phrase, a temple of the spirit. Tell us more about that.
Well, I mean, I think for sure the Rothko Chapel is something that has resonated in the minds of so many artists. And the generation that preceded, let's say, the abstract expressionists, the minimalists, and I use that loosely because I know Ellsworth Kelly would not like to be called per se a minimalist, but often created these environments which married artwork and architecture, often to a spiritual end of some sort. And this was a beautiful project that Ellsworth Kelly did, which is now called Austin, now gifted to the Blanton Museum, or it often called the Kelly Chapel, in 2018, where the artist designed both the structure, again, using the basilical form, and the art on the walls, of course, 14 works, again, mirroring 14 stations of the cross, and stained glass. So this beautiful light creates, again, something non-denominational, but really something that speaks of the spiritual. Dan Flavin, who's an artist that I also knew very well, was interestingly raised as a Catholic, and the very first works he did using off-the-shelf fluorescent lights, just materials you could buy at a hardware store, were called icons in a reference to religion. And although he eschewed religiosity in his work, this was a beautiful commission that was done with the help of the Prada Foundation at a church in Milan, where again, he illuminated the space, and it just creates the most incredible environment. There's no other light source in the building. And similarly, Jim Terrell has done many installations using light and using the sky, artificial light and natural light together. This is a project at a cemetery in Berlin. But the interesting thing, and the sort of leitmotif, if you will, is all these artists are using light and architecture. So it's not painting per se, but when you think of Rothko's work, of course, it was this emanation, the way light emanated from the works themselves and that environment. But so I feel a kind of definite reference, but yet quite different. And this is just one more project by Richard Serra, which is a work he did called London Cross. You see it on the right-hand side, interior, and the exterior of it, a pavilion in Bedford, New York, which in its simplicity, again, reminds me of the early drawings of the Rothko Chapel. Contemporary artists have continued in this vein, and a work by the Chicago-based artist, Theaster Gates, a work called Sanctum from 2015, which she created inside the bombed-out shelter at Bristol's Temple Church using reclaimed materials from religious sites. And this began, while this was temporary, it became a space of performance, a space where he did sound installations 24 hours a day. And last but not least, taking us back to Houston is something slightly different, but again, shows this preoccupation with light and of installation art, of environmental art, of the experiential. And this is a Kusama work from 2009, which is lights and mirrors, an infinity room, if you will. But again, it is that that seeking of something, an experience that I really think emanates again from the precedent of the Rothko Chapel.
Thank you so much. You've got the gorgeous set of images. Makes me long for that kind of light as well at this time of year. Christopher, let me turn to you, to the chapel as it is now, as a lived space. Can you tell us about how it has been and is being used?
Absolutely. The chapel, really from its inception, has not simply been a building where people come to spend time and contemplate. It was from moment one used by the Demoniels as a gathering space and a space for education. So there have been symposia on questions of human rights, questions of religion, religious tolerance, really from its inception. And this is something that we carry forward very much to this day. I do think of the chapel as a living institution, one that is ever fresh in terms of the experience of the artwork, but one that also is really devoted to protecting the human spirit, understanding our fellow people. And this is seen through our many, many programs on human rights work, social justice, and understanding people of other faiths.
I love this image of the whirling dervishes. That's such a remarkable combination of shapes and religious forms, I guess. What about your plans for the future? Tell us more about that.
Well, our plans for the future actually include bringing the whirling dervishes back. Albeit virtually, they're part of our 50th anniversary celebration. You saw that in that picture, though. The dervishes were actually inside the chapel, which I think would make everyone's heart stop today, different moment in the 70s. But it is that type of engagement, which we'd love to continue to do, but recognize is not appropriate to the chapel. That is part of what has driven our project that has been running for the last 5 years and is still moving forward, what we call the Opening Spaces Project. And this is really transforming our campus. It's restored the chapel, but it's also created wonderful new public spaces around the chapel and the new North Campus, where we will have not only the administration building, with for the first time our public our archives available to the public, but a new performance center, a new program center, where many of the things that we can't do, where David actually could come and speak and not worry about the aura of the chapel murals around him. We will be able to do all sorts of film, dance, community events. We can host symposia, in fact, broadcast those to the world. So it really allows us to carry forth this living mission in a much more active and robust way.
My thanks to Christopher Rothko, David Ansam, and Lisa Dennison for their brilliant contributions to today's event.
This was Sotheby's Talks. Thank you for joining us. To step further into the world of Sotheby's, you can visit any of our galleries around the world. They're open to the public. For more information, visit sotheby's.com. Don't forget to follow the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And stay tuned for upcoming episodes of our Legacy series featuring Joachim Pizarro, Christopher Rothko, and Bella Freud. Also catch up on Season 1, which features conversations with guests including Marina Abramović, Mary McCartney, Tracy Emin, Paloma Picasso, and Julianne Moore.